Hi, I'm KSL's Debbie Worthen. 4 years ago, my son Asher was diagnosed with autism. After getting our footing, we decided it was time to celebrate the news with all of you. And that's how Celebrating the Spectrum was born. Each week, we consult with the experts and others who are learning to navigate life with a loved one who has special needs. This is a place where we find hope, look for solutions, and connect with those working to create a better world of inclusion. Thanks for joining us for today's show. Today's guest is Sarah Heuser. Sarah was diagnosed as autistic and having nonverbal learning disorder in 2009. She has a bachelor's degree in behavioral science with an emphasis in psychology and is currently working on her master's to become a licensed clinical social worker. When Sarah was diagnosed, she threw herself into studying autism from an autistic point of view by listening to fellow autistic people while also considering research and academic resources provided by professionals studying autism. She promotes self-advocacy, self-determination, and supported decision-making. And we've been told by her friend Carrie Bushman, who's also here with us today, that she's the pro when it comes to helping people navigate government benefits like Medicaid, food stamps, etc. So we have Carrie Bushman and we have Sarah with us here today. Best friends as well.
Yes.
This is so great. Thanks both of you for being on today.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, let's start at the beginning in 2009.
Okay.
When you were how old and what was this year like for you?
So I was 18. I was repeating my senior year in high school.
Due to bad grades?
Not going to school at all. I had a kind of a complete meltdown in middle school that I was out of school for about a year. So I feel like I kind of missed a lot.
Right.
And I also just missed, a lot of math credits. I hate math.
You're not alone in that.
No.
All right. And so you're repeating your senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know you were autistic?
So I had been watching a TV show that had a very stereotypical man on the spectrum.
Is this the one with the doctor?
It was actually the one. It was called Boston Legal.
Oh, okay.
And it had a guy named Jerry that they actually called Hands because he walked everywhere with his hands on his thighs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about the difference between him that he portrayed when he was among other people and when he would go to court. So when he was in court, he was very boisterous and just very, professional and did a very good job. And then outside of court, his hands would be back on his legs and he wasn't doing that. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's like me when I go outside.
Is he autistic in the show?
Yeah.
And so when you're watching that, what were you thinking?
I was thinking, oh, that's me. Oh, crap. This guy is a weirdo. He's lovable, and all that kind of thing. But I'm also thinking that I thought he was kind of cool,
mm-hmm,
but
right.
I also knew the way he was being portrayed was that not everyone really liked him.
So did you go to your parents and say, hey, so I think I might be autistic, or how did that play out?
I remember I was sitting on the floor and I looked up at my mom and
was she watching the show with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I said, don't you feel like that's kind of me? And she was like, absolutely not. That's never, that is not you.
Mm.
And I was like, oh,
that
okay.
is an interesting response.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Of just that's not you. And then about a year later, she comes to pick me up from the school thing. And she had been reading a book about psychology that had been written for religious clergymen to mm-hmm. just kind of better understand disabilities and disorders. And she was like, it was a little boy, but she was like, this is you.
Hmm.
These examples are you. Not exactly, because of course this little boy loves trains, but mm-hmm. you love dinosaurs and you talk about things that you love nonstop. And that's a great thing. And all these things that I love about you are actually kind of line up with this autism thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she just kind of got set on going and finding someone who could diagnose me. I'm thinking it would help during my second senior year.
The way you say that is funny. But, we hear all the time that it's really tough to get a diagnosis in girls because it shows itself so much differently.
Yes.
And so I can see why your mom was like, no, that's not you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, she had a lot of the stereotypes about autism that a lot of people have, that, it's someone who doesn't talk, which isn't to say that that's never the case.
Right.
But,
so different.
Mm-hmm. But very different, that they can't make a single friend and they don't care about people and all these things. And she's just like, you are too empathetic and da 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 da, which, later as we did research, that's also a trait of autism is over empathy.
And have you always had a lot of friends?
Not a lot, but I've always had like one person that I could like kind of copy, mm-hmm. which apparently is also a very girl autistic thing of like, I find like someone who looks like they're functioning pretty well in the social universe, and I just do everything they do.
That is so fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. So you get that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
What did that change for you?
So I got an IEP, which made it easier for me to take just kind of substitute classes.
An IEP, for those who don't know, that's an individualized education plan.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And so I got an IEP, which made it easier for me to do like certain packets and just take certain classes. It also helped me in college. I was able to take my diagnosis to the accommodations office, and I was able to take the logic in philosophy class rather than a mathematics class because that's the nonverbal learning disorder.
And you hate math.
And I hate math, yeah. The nonverbal learning disorder comes with a diagnosis of dyscalculia, of like I'm just very bad at math in the same way that dyslexics have a hard time with words. And so that was kind of the change, was that I caught a break.
Right.
I had never, like, I didn't have like a legal backup to say like, I need a break with these things. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to be able to leave my classroom when I need to leave my classroom. And I need to be able to listen to music to self-regulate and all those kinds of things that suddenly I was allowed to have.
Yeah, because you wouldn't otherwise.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It's the rule.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it just kind of gave me some legal protections in my school. And I ended up going to a school that was almost, it was Montessori-based.
Okay.
And that ended up being perfect for me.
So, you're 18. Looking back, mm-hmm. and do you mind me asking how old you are now?
Not at all. I'm 31.
31 now. Do you feel like it would have made a huge difference for you growing up knowing you were autistic, or not really?
I go back and forth.
You would have had help early on in school as far as the IEP goes.
Exactly. So, like, would school have been easier, or would it have been more difficult? Because school was very difficult for me. Like, the social aspect of it was very hard. The sensory aspect of it was very hard looking back. And so in those ways, I think it would have been quite useful. I don't know how useful saying I'm autistic would be to other kids.
Maybe more damaging.
Yeah.
Especially at the time. We're making progress.
Exactly.
Are we?
Exactly.
Maybe,
I don't know.
Maybe with little kids. I don't know either.
I don't
okay.
know.
Okay.
I honestly don't know. I don't know if, like, I had some teachers that were bullies. I don't know.
I've heard that a lot from parents. That's awful. Those teachers need to be fired.
Yeah. I feel like every once in a while there's a teacher, like most of the teachers that I had were amazing. Like, I just want to make that clear. But I had a couple of teachers who, you know, I can think of one in high school, one in elementary school, and one in college, that it's almost like they found the person who had the disability and they targeted them directly.
Wow. They sensed like that area of weakness and they pounced.
Exactly.
I hate hearing that.
Yeah.
And when did you and Carrie meet?
So we met when I was at university. So we were both going to school at the same time, and she wanted to start a neurodiversity club and reached out to me, and that was how we met. Neurodiversity just being folks who are not neurotypical.
Yeah, right.
So we kind of got together and just learned that we get along really well and learned that our interests are very much aligned. And rest is history. So it's been, gosh, I don't know when did we graduate?
We graduated in 2015.
Okay. Yeah. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
So. And Carrie, what was it about Sarah that you were attracted to?
Well, I was talking to my professors and I would say, you know what we need? We need a group where these students can get together and help each other out and make friends with each other. Mm-hmm. And we don't really have that here on campus. And
why did you care?
Because
I mean, really, like you're neurotypical. That's most people just would not care enough to do that.
But as I studied autism, I realized the need. Mm-hmm. And the professor said, you can't do anything without Sarah.
Ooh,
and I was
Sarah.
Like,
do you love hearing that?
Who's Sarah?
Who's this Sarah?
I said, Sarah is on the spectrum. She is a great self-advocate. If you're going to do a club, quote unquote, for people on the spectrum, you need to have people on the spectrum in your club and in your leadership, and you need to meet Sarah. So I just looked her up on Facebook and messaged her and said, you don't know me, but you've been recommended to me.
And we're going to be best friends.
Okay, so Sarah, you started, once you knew you're autistic, you started throwing yourself into research.
I do.
What did that look like?
A lot of Google Scholar. But I found wrongplanet.net, I want to say is the name of it. It was a website, but that was specifically made by autistic people for autistic people. It's like a forum type deal. And that was kind of where I first found things. And then I also just kind of decided the moment that they handed me my diagnosis that I was going to work with that, that was going to be like my specialty, was I was going to look into autism, because it was a very emotional experience for me.
Was it?
Of like this very like, oh, I've been this way my whole life, never had a word for it. Spent a lot of time as a child thinking that, like, I was not a human.
We hear that a lot from different autistic adults that we talk to. Just feeling like, you know, everyone else had the rule book, I didn't.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Everyone else, like, had, like, these human instincts that I didn't have. Mm-hmm. And it was very lonely. And the guy who diagnosed me wasn't, like, the nicest person about it.
Oh.
And so when he gave it to me, I was just like, I could do so much better.
Now, so was he just matter of fact, or just did not, like, not great bedside manner? Or what was it?
Very, very not good bedside manner. Mm-hmm. Very just like, here. All the like a list of things that you suck at, and
wow,
which is what I needed. I needed it for school. Like, I needed to be able to hand people like a list of things that I'm not good at, and I needed them to know.
So, what would have been the better approach?
I think
because now you know you can use that going forward.
So I work with people who have diagnoses a lot. I do a lot of writing based on like their weaknesses, and I just tell them like, this isn't how I see you, but this is what you're going to need in order to get services.
Yeah, that's great. That is so perfect.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not, this doesn't define you, but.
Right.
That is, I love that.
Yeah.
This is what you're going to need.
Like, this is, like, I can see your strengths. I can see what autism has done for you. I can see what makes you a great person. None of that is here.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, if we looked at things in a lot of ways, you could point out things that people need help with, but you're not looking at all their great qualities.
Right.
You know, this was just one small part, and this is going to help you get the help that you need in these areas. Okay. What were some of the surprising and not surprising things that you learned?
I kind of thought that like the diagnosis was great. I have a hard time remembering like exactly the mental place I was in. And I think it's because it was two opposing things of like, my life is over and my life is just beginning. Mm. So I would go and I would tell everyone, I would tell my classmates, I'm like, I'm autistic. Doesn't everything make sense now? Like, I put the pieces together and like, I'm autistic. And they'd be like,
okay. Congrats.
I'd be like, and you're autistic. And they'd be like, oh, excuse me. You know, like I would accidentally outed people as autistic because I could now like, I could tell when they were like me, and they were like, I didn't want anyone to know that. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry.
But you've probably met a lot of people who are and have never been diagnosed. Yeah.
And I would never say it now. Like that was a social thing that like I had to kind of figure out for myself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I meet people all the time and I'm like, do they know?
And you know, as a neurotypical person, with my son's diagnosis, it has changed sort of the way we've viewed the world and viewed a lot of people in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's given us a lot more compassion.
Yeah.
You know, a lot more grace. Like, this we can tell this person is obviously autistic.
Right.
They don't know. And if they knew, how would it help them?
Right.
You know, and then you always have that family in your neighborhood with the kid who's like, everyone knows that kid, something is going on. Are they autistic? Are they not? Parents are in denial, you know, all of that. We feel like this is such a huge disservice to everyone involved, the family, the kid, the school, everyone, because we feel like the diagnosis with our son just opened the door to tons of resources.
Yeah.
What were some of the common things that you heard from people?
I got told, I hate this word, but I remember telling like a really close friend of mine, she said, oh, so you're retarded now.
Whoa.
And
what did you say to that?
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I think I was, I don't know if I said anything. I was so like taken aback.
Were you offended?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not even just like based on like, oh, that's something that you've said about me now, but just like I became very, after my diagnosis, I became incredibly protective of autistic people and intellectually disabled people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just because I could see myself in them now.
Everyone with a difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, like, it wasn't even so much like an offense on my behalf as it was of just like a, like, we don't say that word. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not, yeah.
And for teenagers, and I don't know how old you were when that happened.
18.
Yeah. I mean, I hear teenagers say stuff like that. Oh, yeah. And that is one, because I have teenagers who live in my house.
Right.
If one of the friends uses that, mm-hmm. that is the one word I will always correct.
Right.
You know, it's like, or, you know, there's this term now like, oh, that person's so special needs. It's like,
right.
Well, what are you saying? Uh-huh. Because Asher is special needs and you guys all love Asher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are very few things I correct people on, mm-hmm. but that is one of them because I think it's just they say it and they don't even give any credit to the power of that word.
Yeah.
Right. And it was hurtful.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think overall we're getting away from that as a society, which is great. But when we're not, then mm-hmm. we can kindly and sometimes not so kindly, especially as the parent, tell them that's not going to happen here. So what research on autism would you say is most important and what areas of research is needed and not happening? And Carrie, I would like you to weigh in on this as well after Sarah.
So research, I guess my question would be research for whom? So like as an autistic person, my primary research really became like finding other autistic people. Mm-hmm. And seeing what they had to say. And thankfully, that's also where academic research is going as well. When I was first diagnosed, like our the biggest call for research was just like, could you please research something that actually helps us?
Mm-hmm.
Because the research was around kind of eliminating autism.
Fixing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to fix this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, how can we make sure that no more kids are born with this horrible disease? And how can we make like help the people like who have it to be less autistic?
Has there been a pivot?
A little bit.
Okay.
So now it's definitely more, I mean, there's still stuff of like, there's giant, most money, I would say, goes towards like, what is the genetic cause of mm-hmm. autism,
mm-hmm.
which I'm very scared of.
Why?
So the rates of people terminating pregnancies where they know their child's going to be disabled
mm-hmm.
are very high.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying anything political on that on that front. Just
that's
that,
a fact.
Just that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you just making that decision to terminate because you're not going to like that child? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're not
going to be hard?
It's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. Are you, you know, like, whereas if it was any other child, like, you wouldn't terminate mm-hmm. that pregnancy.
So the millions and millions initially uh-huh. were spent on, let's eradicate this.
Yeah.
How do we figure out how this to make this never happen again?
Right. Mm. And a lot of therapies.
Which seems offensive too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Very offensive. Right. A lot of therapies that were kind of scary and harsh and like chelation therapies to get rid of heavy metals in the blood that can kill you if you don't have heavy metals in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
Just that kind of thing was a lot of what I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of like corrective wearables, I think were what they were calling them. So like things that would electrically shock someone if they done something that was wrong. Like
I just hate hearing this.
Yeah.
Okay. But you were 18, this right?
Yeah.
So this was 13 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Are we still seeing that stuff in?
Not nearly as
badly. Okay.
More and more, there's some research. Man, I wish I could remember names and places if geography and names were my thing. But there's some research out of Scotland into something called the double empathy problem
mm-hmm.
that I feel like is an incredible thing to research. It's just essentially that autistic people and neurotypical people just think differently mm-hmm. and relate to one another differently. And that it's actually because when you're autistic, a lot of the time, like I'll be talking to someone and obviously I missed something
mm-hmm.
or I said something and I have no idea what it was. And
you can tell that based on their reaction.
Kind of the way they, you know, and that's a new skill that mm-hmm. I developed pretty much after being diagnosed. But I can tell that, and I can't tell where it went wrong. So this research out of Scotland was fascinating to me because it essentially set up three random people in a room with varying neurodiversities, an observer, a person who is neurotypical and a person who's not neurotypical, so an autistic person. And basically, when the observer observed two autistic people talking to each other, they could not pick up on the autism.
Hmm.
The flow of communication.
That is so fascinating.
The flow of communication was, you know, normal. But as soon as you put in an autistic person with a non-autistic person, the flow of the conversation had the observer thinking, someone in here is autistic, but I can't tell who.
Oh.
So it's literally a communication difference.
Right. Right. A difference.
Right.
I love that. And we've heard on the show before, it would be so kind if when a diagnosis was made, it was not called a disorder, it was called a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Just the tone.
Yeah.
Of the whole thing would change.
Yeah.
All right. So, Carrie, let me ask you, what areas of research do you think we're seeing a lot of and what's needed?
So I tend to focus on adults with autism because I learned that we don't have even statistics on adult autistics in the United States. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many there are. We don't know where they are. It's almost as if once they turn 18, they disappear.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we've done a really good job in learning about children and supporting children. But as far as adulthood, they spend most of their life as an adult that we're not keeping track. We're not doing things that, like Sarah said, not doing things to help them live better lives.
Mm-hmm.
The research money is still very low for directing funds to adult autism is like 10% of the total money that has been allotted for that. So I just find it fascinating to study anything to do with adults.
Right.
Because
yeah.
that is a big gaping hole in research that needs to be filled as fast as possible.
And that's interesting because we see, you know, these therapy centers, and I don't know the amounts of money that they're getting from me and, you know, the insurance, but I know it's significant. And what point does that just stop? It kind of sounds like at 18, like the resources go away, the services go away. If they don't go away, it's a lot harder to find access to those.
Yes.
Right.
They call it the services cliff.
Oh, yeah. That's an excellent way to put it. That's very visual. And it sounds like that's very accurate. We have to take a quick break. We have so much more to talk about. We're going to take a quick break. We're here with Carrie Bushman and Sarah Heuser. And we are going to talk more about self-advocacy, self-determination, and anything else that they want to discuss, because it's all so fascinating when we come back. Welcome back. We are having an incredible conversation with Sarah and Carrie, best friends. Carrie and Sarah met in college, and we're talking about Sarah's diagnosis at 18 and how that's changed her life and some of the research that you've done as well. So I want to get to this, and this is all selfish, by the way, because my son is six. He's autistic. So how would you help neurotypical parents like myself determine if the therapy they're getting their child is working? And this kind of, to me, comes down to the money, because I know everyone wants my money.
Right. And honestly, this is becoming an industry, which is really scary to me. There's people who are making money off of the fact that people are afraid of what's going to happen to their kids. And that's very...
exploiting that fear.
That's very exploitative. And it's very... wrong philosophically, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy of, like, so at the beginning of therapies for autism, the goal was indistinguishability from their peers.
That was the original goal?
Yes.
Okay.
So...
and what were some of the therapies that were based, you know, like, triggered to that, or...
So it's a controversial topic, just so you know.
Yeah.
But ABA therapy.
ABA is so controversial.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot about ABA I love, but I've read some of the stuff.
Yes. So for me, it's a little bit of a fruit of the poisonous tree. Ivar Lovaas was not a kind person. He started ABA out as a, he actually called it the sissy experiment. Mm-hmm. It was conversion therapy for gay boys. And it's very punitive. It was very punitive. Mm-hmm. He was quoted a lot as saying, like, how autistic children are not people yet. Mm. They're not a real child yet. And we're trying to make them into a person.
Okay.
That's, you know, not verbatim, but very right. much the feeling that was conveyed through his interviews. Mm-hmm. And so...
So some of that.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, from my perspective, you know, uh-huh. with our son, who's done a ton of ABA.
Yeah.
It's been great for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
And so there's a lot of stuff. So it depends on who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. So if you talk to an autistic person who is an adult now, probably my age, mm-hmm. 30s, 40s, 50s, who went through ABA, their experience...
No. Okay. I'm scared of what you're going to say.
Their experience of what happened to them is very different. Mm-hmm. ABA, you know, like people have humanized it. Mm-hmm. Like there's been a lot of work to make it more, less punitive, mm-hmm. more redirectional,
right.
more
loving,
loving, uh-huh. more, towards what the child actually needs. Mm-hmm. There's just every once in a while, there's a little leftover thing. So
right.
for instance, a lot of, there's a book called Loud Hands. Mm-hmm. And you'll find a lot of adult autistic perspectives on ABA in there. Specifically an essay by a woman named Julia, and I really wish I could remember her mm-hmm. last name.
Now, is she the Julia that the Sesame Street character is based on?
No.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe she is. I don't know. She actually is the president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network.
Okay.
Now, and she wrote an essay that kind of took off in the autistic community about how she would start hand flapping and her teachers or her parents or her therapist would come and hold her hands.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
Now for her, that was like someone forcibly stopping you from laughing, crying, mm-hmm. sneezing.
That's
like, it was painful.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was something that like was always done at the time.
Hmm.
That was because that would definitely make you distinguishable from your peers.
Right.
If you started hand yeah. flapping.
Okay. Yeah. And you're right. ABA is controversial.
Yeah.
Which we could have those conversations as well.
Forever. And the one thing I will say is that there's also a big disagreement right now in the autism community and the neurotypical community mm-hmm. of like what ABA is.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and talking about going political, this is like critical race theory. You know,
right.
big fight. What is critical
yes.
race theory? And,
yes.
and, you know, like the governor of Utah was basically like, I'm not going to approve this without there being a curriculum. This can't just be any teacher like spewing out what they think critical uh-huh. race theory is. Like, that's just not okay.
Right.
And so that probably is similar, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you sit me down with an ABA therapist, like, they'll probably have a different idea mm-hmm. In some ways of what ABA is to what my idea of ABA
right.
is.
Right. And as the parent, I think, man, that just makes it all that more important to do my
so
research.
Hard.
To make sure I have the right fit.
I would just say watch.
Watch, uh-huh.
A lot of the time, they'll be like, I'll read about ABA therapists that won't let parents in the room.
Mm.
And that makes me think, I
nervous.
Get it.
Right.
I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to work with being directly watched either. But also, would you leave your kid in a room for a medical procedure
right.
alone
right.
the entire time?
Yeah.
Like, how do you know?
Right. And okay, so let's go back to that original question. How do you know it's not working? Well, that's so broad, isn't it? Now
it
I'm
is.
Realizing that's a very broad question.
So my main complaint with therapies these days mm-hmm. is, are you actually helping the person with the emotional turmoil inside, or are you just looking at behaviors?
Okay.
Because I can hold in my behaviors,
mm-hmm.
and it's distressing to me. So I don't hand flap often. But
in private, are you like, I'm going to flap like crazy?
In private, I rock quite a bit.
Okay, yeah.
You know, all those kinds of things. And so if someone is saying like, yes, we have removed this harmful behavior where mm-hmm. this person, you know, starts hitting and stuff like that, are they still experiencing the anxiety that caused them to hit?
Mm-hmm.
Now they're just not hitting and they have no outlet for it at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's a concern to me.
Right, right.
Because those kinds of things are what autistic people call masking. And
right.
masking is directly tied to extreme distress in autistic populations that can lead to harmful, like self-harm and suicidal ideation.
Our pediatrician also told us at one point, if you ever have that pit in your stomach about the therapy or something someone's telling you to do for your child. He's like, even me, if you walk out of here and you just think, oh, I just don't feel good about that. He's like, trust that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you promote self-advocacy, self-determination, and supported decision-making. Now, I thought it was interesting because supported decision-making actually had like a little initial by it, which made me think, oh, that's like something official.
Yes. Yes and no.
Okay.
So supported decision-making is the alternative to guardianship.
Okay.
It's
okay. Yeah, that's, yeah. This makes sense for the initials. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. So kind of has its origins in Texas with a very interesting case. Gosh, today is not a day for names. I cannot remember her name, but she had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Jenny. She has Down syndrome, had no guardianship for a very long time, and then was in a car accident, was struck as a pedestrian by a car, at which point her parents got guardianship over her and put her in a home where she was treated
badly.
Very badly. Mm-hmm. So she went and found an attorney who would work with her, and they came up kind of with supported decision making. So instead of having guardianship is kind of complicated in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
There's full guardianship and there's partial guardianship. Most guardianships in Utah are partial.
Okay.
So
and you're talking for adults.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so but this supported decision making is more like, you need help with money, so I'm on your bank account.
Gotcha.
You need help with making decisions about your medical health, your medical decisions. So I have a power of attorney
right.
for that.
Right.
Instead of having like this carte blanche, like you are my guardian, it's more of like you have someone to talk and recommend things that you do.
Much different.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So self-advocacy. Mm-hmm. I can see that you would be a great self-advocate.
Yeah.
I mean, you're so well-spoken. You're so knowledgeable. You know, you've studied this now. I can't wait for you to be a social worker. You'll be amazing.
It'll be fun.
And so talk about that. Like, how would you help someone do that?
So self-advocacy for me began very early. My mom was constantly advocating for me with those bully teachers that I was talking to you about.
Go mom.
Yeah. Yeah. And, around college time, she just kind of said, you know, like, this is going to be you for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to figure out how to do this on your own. So I just kind of started getting into the self-advocacy scene, and the autistic adult, kind of community is very self-advocacy based of just like, here's how I want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how I do not want to be treated. And here's how I think other people like me should be treated.
And is it along the same lines as, and here's what I need.
And yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Of yeah. Carrie's got this definition of like self-advocacy, and advocacy is getting your needs met.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
If my needs aren't getting met, no one, now that I'm an adult, there's not anyone else to make sure that that happens other than me.
Is that scary?
It was in the beginning, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I had really good people to look up to see like what this self-advocacy was going to look like, what my mom had done.
Mm-hmm.
It became less scary. Still scary.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that is. And okay. And then self-determination. Is this something we can teach?
I think so.
Okay. And I mean across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's another problem that I have with some of the therapies that we do today is it's very compliance based.
Mm-hmm.
So which is understandable. Like I need to be able to touch my child to get them into the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Did you first learn like I look at it as like the hugging issue. When I was little, my mother never made me hug anyone that mm-hmm. I didn't want to hug. So if a
grandparent was so ahead of her time.
Yes.
Wasn't she?
So like a grandparent wanted a hug. That was too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like I got to make that decision who touched my body
mm-hmm.
And what I was going to do with my life and all those kinds of things. So I see a lot of people come to the place that I work now.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is that Scenic View?
Yeah.
Scenic View Academy. Yeah.
Scenic View Academy.
Right.
And they'll say, okay, so what am I going to do now? And my heart just kind of breaks because I'm like, oh, so that's the therapy we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Or that was the kind of the home basis of like, I will tell you what to do
mm-hmm.
and that is how you're going to live your life. And then when they turn 18, they get sent away from home to us, wherever, college, wherever. Now they don't know what to do. So that self-determination of just like, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to make mistakes, and it's going to be okay.
How would you help parents of little kids or kids who are teenagers, they're autistic, start thinking that way in their early and formative years?
Evaluating consequences. So if I know that my kid, if my kid does this thing, the consequence is going to be horrible. I don't know. Something that's going to
run into the street?
Run into the street. Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that. You know, I would say, yeah, you need to put consequences in order of just like saying, like, you realize the street's dangerous. You could be hit by a car, If it's more like I'm going to eat this thing, like these candies that are going to make me feel sick, and I know that that this child is going to feel sick, I would let them make the mistake.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So not when it's life and death.
Yeah.
But in something where it's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because mistakes are how people learn.
And then as the parent, do you kind of go over that?
Yeah.
Now you realize you ate that.
Yeah.
And this is why. And that is a natural consequence.
Right. Because a trait of my particular spice of autism is that I can have a hard time realizing what's happening to me or how I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. So if someone says, oh, you did that thing, and now how does it make you how did it make you feel? That is more helpful in learning that consequence for me than if I just did it over and over and over again without someone saying.
So making that correlation to how did you feel when that happened?
Yeah. Instead you forgot to take your meds 3 days in a row.
Right.
How did that make you feel?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So Carrie, you and Sarah kind of spearheaded OtCon, which we've talked about a little bit before. And you have this story that you love that Sarah tells. And Sarah, tell us about this. And you touched on it earlier. You said when you were a kid, you actually didn't feel human. And you meant literally you did not feel human.
Yeah. Yeah. So the way I say it is I was waiting for the spaceship to come back for me.
And like, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I was
like literally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, but I was more less sci-fi of a child and more fantasy of a child. So I kind of thought I was in the wrong realm. Or I had been I was gonna develop something someday that would make it obvious like what was different about me.
See, I told you all.
Yeah. I'm just like, and that was kind of the autism. I think that's why I went everywhere and was like, it's the autism. It's autistic. I'm autistic. I'm not a witch. I told my therapist I was a vampire when I was like 6 years old because I kind of saw myself in Wednesday Addams. And I asked my mom, what is Wednesday Addams? And she's like, I don't know, like a vampire?
Yeah.
And so I went to my therapist and I was like, I am a vampire.
Yeah.
And she, you know, had to convince me that I wasn't. So like, you know, now working in the psych field, like if a kid told me that, I know how a lot of people would react as like, oh, there's like something going on there. But for me, it was just literally like, I am not like other people.
Mm-hmm.
There's something incredibly different about me. I am waiting for someone to come and tell me, like, what's different about me and how I'm going to make it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. When I'm sitting here talking to you, it's absolute pleasure, by the way. I mean, it breaks my heart that someone would say there's something wrong with you.
Right.
And I love talking to people, all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And it's incredible to talk to you and just listen to you talk about your experiences. So OtCon, is there a stigma to the autistic community of these autism conferences talking about you as autistic people?
Less so now, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first diagnosed, I was super into like the research side of it, the academia side, and because that's kind of how my brain works. It was all so dehumanizing.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Everything I read was like, can we shock these kids into working better?
Mm-hmm.
Like, can we medicate these kids? Like, are they suffering from heavy metal poisoning? Can we give them bleach?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just all this kind of stuff that, you know, was being treated real, like as a real ideas within a community.
Which seems shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, no pun intended.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And do you feel like it's changed now, though, where it's like most of those conferences are talking about the sensory issues and how we can accommodate? I mean, has there been that shift?
There's definitely been a shift. I think people have been listening. People have been realizing, you know, that, yeah, like maybe we should just talk about making your life livable.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice.
Right.
And now that I'm in the professional sphere, I'm much more likely to go to those conferences. But I still hear things every once in a while that makes me think,
we haven't come as far as you want.
Yeah.
But you know what I love about you and just your perspective and your experience growing up like this? Mm-hmm. And when I say like this, meaning like not knowing.
Yeah.
You know, not knowing. And now you're in this field where you get the chance to educate both sides now.
Right.
I mean, what a value that brings to the world in general.
It's been nice.
that is really incredible. What should society know and where do you want things to go?
I'm a big fan of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do great work. They're out of Washington, D.C., and they actually paid to educate me in some of their ways. I owe them a great debt. I think their website is amazing. I think just going online and seeing people, I mean, you're going to see a lot of crap too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just kind of the nature of people.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of disagreements, lots of ideas that people are going to argue over, and that's okay.
Do you love the fact, though, that there are constant discussions going on?
I kind of do.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of do. Sometimes I find it exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
But other times, I'm just really grateful that the conversation has become bigger.
Right. And awareness is, I mean, I don't want awareness. I want acceptance.
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
exactly.
Awareness was a great start.
Yeah.
And that was a great place. Yeah. And now let's move on.
And it was needed at the time. Like, I feel like people weren't aware of what autism actually was.
And we're all still learning all the time, too.
Exactly.
Right.
But I feel like we have gotten to acceptance and celebration.
And celebration. Right. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
So Carrie Bushman and Sarah Heuser, it's been a great conversation. We'll definitely have you back. We need to talk more about the government benefits because she's the pro. We didn't even get to touch on that.
And
that could probably be an entire series.
Most likely.
Thank you so much. And Celebrating the Spectrum is a KSL podcast.